Moncrief on News Talk
with the Dacia Duster. Shockingly affordable, and now with 3 months deferred payments too.
53106 is our text number. That will cost you 30 cents. You can follow us on Facebook or Twitter or send us an email to afternoon@newstalk.com. Joanna Fortune joins us once again. Good afternoon, Joanna.
Good afternoon, Sean.
Right, here's your first question. My six-year-old son is very affectionate and tactile. He always gives my husband and I kisses and hugs and kisses his baby brother a lot too. It's very sweet and I don't mind him doing it to his grandparents and extended family like cousins, and they all don't seem to mind. But he does it with friends and even kissed the man who worked in the shoe shop a few months ago. I was really shocked by that, as was the man. I apologise and told my son not to do that. He doesn't seem to understand when I tell him he can't kiss everyone. It upsets him when I say I only kiss mommy, daddy, his brother and grandparents. I don't want him to lose his gentle and loving nature, but to be a bit more wise to these things. How do I get through to him?
You can't help but go, gosh, you know, he sounds like such a lovely, you know, sensitive little boy with a big heart. But at the same time, I totally get what this parent is saying. And at 6 years old, you know, you can and probably should have a chat with him about body boundaries and about consent, and explaining very clearly that it means everyone agrees and is happy to say yes. And you, in order for him to really integrate what you're talking about, because he's still 6 years old, you know, you'll have to play that out with him. So you could do it in a role play. He's at the age where he'd be well able for that, where you can model consent with him and say, you know, may I give you a hug or a kiss, or would you prefer a high five? Let him choose, and then have him ask you back and you say, oh, actually, you know, a high five would be great today, or do something like that. Because I think it's important as well that you talk to him about there being lots of ways to express love and affection, and that kisses and hugs are really good, as you've already explained, him with, you know, family and extended family. But with people we don't know, that's probably a bit much for them. So we might wave or smile or wink. High fives are probably a little bit contentious at the moment. So you might be talking about shoulder bumps or toe taps, things like that. But showing him that there are many different ways of doing this. And even within your family, explaining to him that, you know, he can kiss using his mouth, or do an, you know, an Eskimo kiss, rubbing noses, or a butterfly kiss, blinking his eyes against a cheek. Just so you're showing him there are lots and lots of ways of expressing love and affection, because he clearly has a lot of it that he has to share and express. And that's a good thing, but it has to be done within boundaries. Mm. And at six, they're well able for that conversation.
Right. OK. But I suppose he might bring up the question of why, but I like the man in the shoe shop, and why shouldn't I express affection to him too?
And that's exactly it. So that's the consent piece, that of course you're happy to do that, but we have to make sure that he's happy to receive that. So that's why we would give him a choice. We would say, do you want to shake hands, bump elbows, wave, or would you like a hug? You know, that he knows that he can give people a choice, and that then he must, you know, respond in accordance with their choice, but that everybody gets to make that choice. I think that's, it's just a way, you're not saying don't hug anyone, don't show affection, because actually that would be very confusing for a child whose natural inclination is to be very emotionally expressive. But to show him there are lots of ways of doing it, and for people who are really close to us,
yeah,
we do it this way. And for people who are a little bit less close, who are on the outer circle, we do it a different way.
My 17-year-old teenage daughter has an utter intolerance of any eating sounds, such as crunching, slurping, chewing, etc. With any eating sounds, such as crunching, slurping, chewing, when the complaining started years ago, my husband and I found it amusing, but now it is anything but funny. She gets so angry with me, as I have a clicking jaw when I eat due to arthritis. Also, my knee joint cracks or clicks when I walk or turn. My husband and I are at our wit's end. She gets so annoyed and angry with us, saying, I can't help my condition, misophonia. The situation is becoming intolerable for our family. Her sisters don't seem to make any sounds that annoy her.
Oh, gosh. I mean, look, misophonia is such a complex condition, and it's so grossly misunderstood that there tends to be this frustration on everybody's part in a family, because you literally just don't know what to do about it. You know, if you have a clicking jaw, you can't, it's not like you can switch it off and say, well, I won't click today. But at the same time, your daughter, her experience is real and she can't control that either. So misophonia is exactly as described here. It's an intolerance, a heightened sensitivity to lots of sounds, but particularly eating sounds or food sounds. It's interesting, they say, you know, we found it amusing years ago when it started, because actually the symptoms of misophonia tend to kick in about 9 to 13 years old. Mm. Now, it can start at any age, but that tends to be the dominant age we see it. A mild reaction, if you're someone who has mild misophonia, so to speak, you might present with, you know, the sounds of people eating around you could trigger things like a mild to moderate level of anxiety, irritability, discomfort. But a more severe reaction is rage, anger, panic, extreme emotional distress, and absolutely not being able to cope with it. And what you're describing here at by 17 years old is sounding at that more or towards that more severe level of reaction. I mean, there's actually very little research in this area in terms of what is it, what causes it, what is it linked to, where does it come from. I mean, there are some possible links being made with sensory processing challenges. And in that context, perhaps consulting with an OT, an occupational therapist, might be able to do something in terms of supporting her, because I do think she needs support. And by getting her some support, you'll all benefit from it. The therapeutic supports that have shown, you know, some effectiveness would include things like sound therapy, talk therapy to some extent as well, and even behavior therapy. And there's a couple of other things as well. But you have to try and imagine from her point of view, it's like that feeling center of her brain, her amygdala, is stuck on fight flight mode. You know, and fight flight mode is a really, you know, life-saving adaptive function we all have, that if we're faced with threat, our brains know to trigger stay and fight, or run and save yourself, or freeze and save yourself. But it becomes maladaptive if you're stuck on that alert system all the time and your brain is saturated with stress responses. And for her, that eating experience and being around noises, it can trigger a chronic state of that. So you want to go to her and really acknowledge her suffering with acceptance and empathy. You know, say, look, I know this is really hard for you, and I really wish that I could change how I eat, but I also have to acknowledge that's not something I can do. And I'm really sorry about that and how hard it is for you. So I'd really like to be able to help you to manage this better. And I'm wondering what might help. Now, a 17-year-old might say, well, it would help if you'd stop doing that clicking. And you can say, I bet it would. But as I said, I can't stop that because that's the way my jaw works. So what else could we do? And it might be, would it help you to maybe start your meal a bit ahead of us, you know, or eat after us? And if you're going to be eating alone, maybe we could go for a brief walk after dinner, so we're still having that time to connect. You know, that you offer some alternatives. Some people that, you know, certainly that I've worked with around this have found using, you know, noise cancelling headphones have been helpful. Regular and increased levels of exercise have helped, and ensuring that there's a good quality sleep, that you're not, you know, staying up till 1 or 2 a.m., but getting a proper 8-9 hours sleep a night, that can actually really help. But also that within the home, if you've got the space, and if not, just to try even a small space within the space to create a quiet corner that she can retreat to, and that everybody in the family knows that if she's there, it's her way of signaling, I need no noise. I need no noise so that I can calm down and I can regulate, because otherwise I'm going to be irritable and angry. And everybody works with her because this is a condition that she cannot control otherwise. Mm. And I think that could be really, really helpful around it. But I think if not, you might want to consult with your doctor about getting even an initial referral to an occupational therapist who may have more insight into managing the sensory aspect around sound and being able to modulate some of the symptoms around that. It's just, you know, because so little is known about it, it's often a misunderstood condition. You know, it's often something that, oh, you know, it's, we think of it as an OCD, but actually it's not OCD. It's something in and of itself. Mm. So you might want to, you know, do a little bit of looking up online and seeing, are there any support groups of people who also experience this, that your daughter could speak with somebody who really gets it. But I would encourage you to do some therapeutic. If she's open to it, she's 17, she absolutely would have to be willing to go into therapy, but that actually you can support her around that. I think that would help. But acceptance and empathy, acknowledging it's really, really difficult, because if it's going on years and it was something that was more casual at home, like, oh gosh, you know, isn't she gassed? Yeah. This happens. Actually, it's amplifying for her and she needs it to be taken seriously.
Yeah.
I was really interested about the line, you know, her sisters don't make any sounds that annoy her. And I was immediately going, how, what are they doing? How are they managing? You know? So it would be good to be curious about that, you know, and ask your daughter, you know, clearly we're doing something that's triggering you and your sisters are not. So what can we do to maybe change and help? But I think if you come at it from a position of we want to better understand this and support you through it, I think actually it'll be transformative for all of you.
Yeah, but as you say, so little research has been done into it. It's not entirely clear why certain sounds set people off and others don't.
Exactly that, you know, and I think that's part of the frustration for anybody who has misophonia is that it's often dismissed as, oh, sure, it's in your head, you're just intolerant, oh, it's just this. And actually, when that happens, it's just evidence that there isn't enough research and we don't know enough. But what we do know is that people who experience this, it's really, really difficult.
Yeah, yeah. I am looking for a little advice on how to prepare my 4-year-old son and 2-year-old daughter for the arrival of, wait for it, 3 new siblings. My husband and I are still wrapping our heads around the fact that we're going to go from 2 kids to 5 in one go. Maybe Joanna can come and live with us for, say, the next 16 to 18 years. I think that's probably the best option, Joanna.
I have my bags packed. I'm dying to do that. Oh, my goodness. Well, congratulations on the new babies. And my straight away, start saying yes and say it loudly and be specific. People will be going, oh, you know, let us know if we can help you. Yes, you can. Here is very specific things that you can do to help us, because you're going to need a network. You're going to need a whole network around you to help you. And that's okay. So when people offer to help, say, yes, it would be great if we could stockpile, you know, dinners in the freezer. It would be great if you'd be able to come one evening a week and someone else come another evening to help us with bedtimes. It would be great if you could give me an hour to have a shower, a hot cup of tea, and just dress myself. That would be great. So make a list of things that would be really helpful for you and be specific. Don't be shy. Don't be polite. If people are offering to help, take the hand off them. You know, when you're expecting multiples, and particularly, you know, you're going to have 5 kids under 4 years old, that there are, you know, obviously there are medical considerations to a multiples pregnancy and birth. There are logistical, financial, emotional challenges along the way. And you really matter in this. Like this triplet pregnancy is a high risk pregnancy, and you're going to need a lot of support and self-care as well. And I'm going to say this, and then I'm going to maybe qualify what I mean by, because all that came into my mind when you were reading that was, oh, you need to plan to corral these kids. Like, you're going to need to be able to corral this situation.
It's herding, not parenting.
Exactly. You know, I'm blending in some farming here. But, you know, I think, you have to build a safe play space that is contained and containable, because there are practicalities, you know, the needs of the 2-year-old, the needs of the 4-year-old and 3 little ones. How are you going to manage and juggle all of that? So you want to get some of those little spongy squares, those nice child-friendly, very appropriate little gate things that, you know, like a big playpen area, because a playpen won't be big enough for 3, or if you throw the 2-year-old in for 4 kids, you know, but being able to contain and manage is going to be really important. Structure is vital. You know, having a very predictable routine, that's going to be, you know, I mean, it's vital for you as much as for the kids, but that, you know, you have little rituals, because the predictability of that is going to instill safety and security for the children. Because if you're frazzled, they're frazzled too. And frazzled children are just going to amplify your own stresses as well. And you want to make sure that you've opportunity to build in waves of activity. And what I mean by that is make sure you're getting out of the house, even if it takes an hour and 15 minutes to get everybody coated, booted, and as soon as you turn the key in the door, someone needs the toilet and you have to go back and do that and come out. Because once you are out, the fresh air, the movement, the change of scenery will actually benefit you all. So I think you want to make sure that you can build that into your day. And as best you can, here I'm doing my wish list for you now, you know, you need a 15-minute breather for yourself, and that's where your support network comes in. I mean, there is the Irish Multiple Birth Association. They have a website, imba.ie. I think that would be well worth looking up and just linking in with some other parents who, you know, could be at the end of the phone and just give you a bit of support. Well, here's what worked for me. Here's how we approached it. Here's the challenges and here's the highs. You know, here's the fun of it as well and everything that comes with that. So I think linking in with them would be great as well. But more than anything, in order to, you know, keep all of this together, you have to keep yourselves together as parents. So checking in with yourselves, tagging each other in and out, and pulling in all available hands to help is going to be crucial.
Yeah, absolutely. God love them. When they had their second child, there was probably concerns about, you know, the first one, you know, with the question we've got many times before.
Yes.
But for the two remaining kids, you've got this, they're suddenly outnumbered apart from everything else.
Oh, and there's no point in saying you won't be consumed and busy. Of course you will. You've got three newborns all at once, you know, so that's real. So when your children are like reacting that I'm not getting enough of you, it is about you saying, look, I just don't have all of that to give. So how can I compensate? You're going to build in family playtime. And that is about getting outside or just sitting, having the babies, you know, lying on a rug or in my corral that I mentioned earlier and rolling a ball around between you, passing a balloon around between you. Because actually the benefit is that they are all so close in age. The play you can do with them as a little group as they grow up will actually be possible to play as a family. Their play needs won't be so misaligned that the needs of one is so different to the needs of the other. So that's a good benefit. But the early days of, you know, having babies and toddlers, it's really a work phase of parenting. It's constant tasks and demands and doing. Mm-hmm. So you do want to build those opportunities for play and fun in there for the sake of the 4-year-old and 2-year-old, but also yourself so that you still are enjoying your parenting. Your house is going to get really busy and really active, even more so than having a 4-year-old and 2-year-old, which is already a particular, you know, rhythm, you know, to parenting two young kids together as well. But I think if you just keep saying yes, build a community. I think if you see that this is something you guys have to do on your own, it's going to be really challenging. But if you see it as something that people are available and willing to help you with and get stuck in, then think about it. It takes a community. Use that idea.
Yeah, you have your tribe already and never say no. Right, we do have to take a break. After that, a 14-year-old who might have depression. 53106 is our text number. That will cost you 30 cents. Joanna Fortune is still with us. One of the questions Joanna was dealing with was about a 17-year-old who has misophonia, which is it's a dread, but you kind of can't stand the sound of certain noises people make when they're eating. It sounds like a made up thing, but it's actually come up before, actually, many times in this particular segment of the show. Una says, I feel her pain. My son is 3 and he's such a trigger for me when he eats. Not much I can do about it, though, bar encourage a closed mouth. It makes me shudder. Siobhan says, my husband knows I can't stand the sound of chewing for a fight. So if we're fighting, he'll use it against me. It's unfair warfare. Though Mary says, poor girl, she really has misophonia and so do I. I've mostly managed to disguise it, even with family members. I make an excuse to leave the room if the horsey apple eating or general crunching and slurping gets too much. The sound of my father, this is the interesting line, the sound of my father snacking on his crackers and Marmite at night used to make me insane with rage, she says. And that's come up before about misophonia. It makes people angry.
Yeah. And that's the severe level reaction, you know, is that what can start off as, oh, I'm a bit uncomfortable around that. And lots of people have a level of sensitivity around food noises where, you know, I don't love that. And it's, you know, it kind of set my nerves on edge or, you know, I'm uncomfortable. But a severe reaction is rage, is fear, is panic, is absolute anger. And that's what's described here. And that's very difficult to cope with. It really is.
Yeah, indeed. Right. Next question is this. I have suffered from bouts of depression over the years. I try to hide it from my 2 sons, but naturally enough, they picked up on it. I would stay in bed sometimes for days. My eldest is 14 years of age and he started to act in a similar way and copy my behaviour. He withdraws a lot, sits in his own room, stays in bed sometimes until 3:30 or 4 p.m. He could go 2 days before we realised he hadn't talked out loud. My husband thinks this is normal teenage behaviour, but I'm concerned given that this can be my behaviour too. I don't want to worry him unnecessarily. How do I talk to him about it?
This is so difficult. And I think when, you know, you're a parent who's been there and had struggles with mental illness like depression, it of course makes you sensitive to, gosh, have I passed this along to my kids? And really hypersensitive. And yet, as your husband's saying, if you just take each of the things you've said here of themselves, a teenager staying in bed most of the day is actually not, you know, abnormal. It's not even unusual for many of them. Sitting on their own in the room, seemingly withdrawing, particularly from parents and family members, because they're at that age where, you know, the hub of important, you know, social circle is their peers, not their family. They do prioritize peers over family. And so in and of themselves, you'd say, okay, well, that is okay. That's normal. Going 2 days and then realizing he hasn't spoken out loud, that's a little more for me. Mm. That would make me go, oh, okay, that's something quite significant. And like any of this, if you just take each symptom in and of itself separately, you go, that's okay, that's okay. But it's when you knit a pattern of symptoms together that you say, okay, I understand where your concern is coming from. And that's not me saying, yes, he sounds depressed, because I don't think I could make that assessment just based on this. However, you have gone through that awful time yourself and also have worked so hard to try and conceal it from your sons. But as you've identified, you just can't do that. Children are very tuned into their parents, and they see and observe. And even if they don't fully understand it, they will seek to make sense of it and go, did I do something? Could I make you better? What's that about? So I think it is important that if you haven't already, that you do speak openly about your own experience. And because by you talking about it, and I don't mean, you know, flood them with every single detail, but that you do speak about it, you're cueing them that it is okay to talk about your mental health. It is okay to talk about mental well-being and struggles in mental well-being in our family. That is something we can talk about together in a very open and honest way. In terms of then going back, you know, to your son and how he's behaving, because it can be very easy to confuse signs of depression with typical adolescent development, but also it can be very easy to confuse typical adolescent development as depression. So it is a little bit of both from both your perspectives. What I'd really be looking at is, are these feelings, these behavior states, something that come and go? You know, are they temporary? Is it that, you know, a couple of days he's in bed, but mostly he's not? A couple of days he might withdraw and then he doesn't? Or is this something that's more pervasive, constant, simmering, and actually gradually increasing? Either way, I would be saying, you know, reflect to him, sit down with him and reflect with him that you've noticed changes in his behavior. So he gets gotten by you. You know, I've seen that this is happening. Here's what I've seen. And don't panic about it, but wonder. I'm wondering how you're feeling. I'm wondering how things are going in your world, in your life. And be really clear that you're always available to listen and to help, and that he's not alone with this. By simply saying, look, I've noticed that things have changed, and I'm wondering, is there something that I could do to help? Even if that's just listen to you and check in with him regularly on that, you're letting him know that you get it and that he could come to you. I would also say, just the bit that I keep going back to, that he could go 2 days before you realize he hasn't spoken out loud. I mean, look, I work with a lot of teenagers and parents saying, oh, they don't communicate. And the teenager saying, gosh, I don't know what they're talking about. I'm communicating all the time. I'm constantly communicating. But they mean in a virtual, you know, phone based way, and not locking eyes with anyone, not opening their mouth to speak. It's more that navel gazing into a screen, but constantly in communication. So is it that? Is he actually in contact with peers all the time on his phone? But in these COVID times that we're living in, of course, his direct contact and access to his peers has utterly changed. And if that's where he was getting all of his social stimulus and he's not seeing them in person, there does need to be something to offset that loss. Because look, he's 14 years old. It's peak brain development stage for adolescence, and being denied those opportunities for appropriate social engagement with peers at that peak brain development stage is likely to be impactful of mental well-being for our teenagers, especially if it was to go on much longer than this. And we're all hoping, for lots of reasons, that schools and everything get back to normal in September, for all of those reasons, but for me, including mental health. I do think if, as a family, you can establish a practice of one meal together each day with some degree of conversation. It doesn't matter how fluffy or light it is, at least he's speaking to you. And it could be that you structure it going, so, hey, everyone, what was the best bit of your day today? If we could change the day, what would we change about it? Or did you hear about this? I heard something on the radio, so that you're kickstarting the conversation. And even if they just give you kind of, no, oh, really? Is that it? At least it's something and it's an engagement. So when we're looking at the difference between that's a teenager being a teenager versus I'm a bit worried about that, you're looking for sudden sustained changes in behavior. And if you're worried, talk to him about it. And if he says, yeah, actually, I have been feeling low, or now that you say that, or maybe I would like to talk to somebody, reach out to your GP and seek a referral, either to CAMHS, you know, Child and Adolescent Mental Health Services, or to that your GP might have someone in your locality as well that they could recommend privately. But at 14 years old, you do need him to be open to doing that, even if he only agrees to go to see somebody once or twice. to give it a go, I would take that. But if he's saying, no, I'm fine, just keep checking in with him and get that family mealtime thing up and running as quick as you can.
Yeah, because I suppose you can, you know, leave the door open, but it doesn't necessarily mean he's going to walk through it.
Exactly that. So just because you've said I am available, you know, you do need to keep being available. And I don't mean, you know, being in his face going, do you want to talk now? Do you want to talk now? Do you want to talk now? But actually saying, you know, come on, let's go for a walk together. You know, inviting contact so that if only to stop you asking, he'll say, fine, let's go do the walk. I would take that.
Yeah.
That'd be good enough for me. I would say, great. If you feel obliged, I'll still take it. And just try to get those moments of meeting and opportunities for connection active. But I do think we have to be really understanding that this lockdown period has been particularly challenging for teen, that early stage adolescence of, you know, 13 to 15 years old. It has been really, really difficult on them. And we do need to be very empathic about how we approach that.
Joanna, thanks a million for talking to us today and this week. That's Joanna Fortune there talking to her again, of course, this time next week. We're going to take a break after that. Notes and a silencing.
Moncrief on News Talk.
With the Dacia range. Drive away today with no payments for the first 3 months.